Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. Visit speakuptalkradio.com. And today I'm quite looking forward to my conversation with our guest. And I know this may sound strange, but his picture on his website with a caption asks, "Why is he smiling?" And for some reason, that caused me to smile back at his picture on my computer. And luckily, I was alone and my cat was sleeping, so no one saw me. But it was then that I knew I had to talk with him. So who is the smiling man? He is John Byrne Barry. John wrote his first book-length project in fifth grade at Kilmer School in Chicago, a 140-page treatise on dinosaurs. One page for each dinosaur and lots of white space. And he's been writing ever since, magazine and newspaper stories, political comedy, plays, novels, and more. He's even written advice columns, Question the Authority, and The Lazy Organic Gardener. His first published novel, Bones in the Wash, is a political thriller set during the 2008 presidential campaign in New Mexico. His second, Wasted, is a green noir mystery set in the Berkeley recycling world. And he's working on a third novel, a family drama about euthanasia. He lives in Mill Valley, California, with his wife and his family, and I am so anxious to get going. So welcome to the show, John.
Hi, I'm just trying to remember what I was smiling about.
I was going to ask you, why are you smiling?
I don't know, but I do. Smiling is a good thing, and if I can smile, I do it, but sometimes when I pose for pictures, I don't.
Oh, it was awesome. Like I said, I found myself smiling back, and then I'm thinking, wow, this is a little crazy. I'm smiling at the computer, but actually
maybe because someone was taking my picture. That was why I was smiling. And they said, smile.
There you go. You were just following instructions.
Right.
Oh, you're funny. I also read on your website that you once shared the stage with Jackson Brown and Willie Brown, so we need to know about that before we talk about your books.
Oh, well, actually, that was a good while ago. I was in a theater group in the late 70s, early 80s called the Plutonium Players. We also did some subgroups called Ladies Against Women and Reagan for Shah. So it was a political satire group, and we sort of grew out of the anti-nuclear power movement, and there were a lot of large protests and demonstrations. And because a lot of them were filled with important but boring speeches, they often put in, you know, little comedy skits in between. So that's how we got into some of those bigger ones. But the big ones actually also included the people like Jackson Brown and did I say Willie Brown? Jerry Brown. It was Jerry Brown.
Oh, okay. Right? Jerry Brown. Okay.
Well, Willie Brown is also another one. We call them the Brown brothers, but they're not related.
Okay. All right. So you always had a little leaning toward political side of things.
And in fact, I was thinking about this before the call. I think part of it is that politics is a very messy business, and it requires people, even the people of the highest integrity, to figure out the right way to do things. And one of my characters in Bones in the Wash, the protagonist, his name is Tomas Zamora. He's the Republican mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he's the chair of the John McCain campaign for the state. He likes to say that politics is like playing football on a muddy field. If you don't get dirty, you're not giving your all. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just politics. Politics is just one of the places where morality of doing the right thing is played out. Family is another place. So I like the nuance of things, and not black and white characters, but people who have to, tell a little white lie in order to get what they want. Mm-hmm. And politics, of course, is the area where that happens. There's more lying in politics than a lot of things, let's put it that way.
Exactly.
Even by good people.
Well, exactly. It's a great arena for that. And we're going to talk a little bit more about doing the right thing. Now, you wrote the book Wasted first. You set it aside for a few years while you wrote Bones in the Wash that you just mentioned. How and why did that come about?
Well, it came about because I had been a writer for much of my life, but I didn't have the idea or the energy or whatever to write a novel until midlife, and I was already doing some journalism, like covering recycling issues for a local weekly, and I wrote a long piece called The End of Garbage. I visited all sorts of landfills and transfer stations and talked to a lot of people involved in that, and ended up with something that was very good. It took me a long time to get it done. And a number of people who saw the piece in the paper said, well, you should write a book. And I thought to myself, well, yeah, I'd like to write a book, but I don't really want to write a nonfiction book. I don't actually even read nonfiction books that much, some, but not that much. So I thought, well, what if I wrote a novel but set it in the world of garbage and recycling? Because garbage and recycling are the themes that are available there, discarding that those things that no longer serve us, you know, reinvention, recycling, becoming something different than you were. There, it just and the whole idea of garbage itself. I mean, we are in some respects what we throw away. So the opportunity to write a novel based in that world appealed to me. I took a few classes and ended up writing this book. I had this writing group I was in for 12 years, and they read Wasted many times. And then I did the whole getting it out to agents path and sent it out to about 80 or 90 agents and got 8 or 9 nibbles and 2 who wanted to read the whole book and 1 who I was sure was going to take me out as a client, but she didn't. So I thought, okay, well, I wrote my novel. I'll get on with my life. And then somehow I started writing another book. So I guess I got addicted to the process and having those people's lives in my head as I went about my day to be thinking about what happened to these people that I made up.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, and now I guess I am hooked because I'm doing another one.
Oh, I know, and I'm excited to talk about that one. I have a great interest in that as well. Yeah, maybe give us a brief synopsis of the book Wasted.
Okay, well, Wasted is a little bit simpler than Bones in the Wash in the sense that there's one protagonist, and it's first person. The book follows a man named Brian Hunter, who's a wannabe investigative journalist. He's at a challenging time in his life. He's split up from his wife. He's got this bookkeeping business, but it's not very exciting. So he decides, oh, I'm gonna get back into some writing. So he covers the recycling wars in Berkeley, and that's the, by the wars I mean sort of a fight between the homegrown recycling collective full of the true believers versus the big corporation that's now used to do garbage and now is doing recycling and wants to take over everything. And it's an easy way to sort of make that a white and black, you know, good guys, bad guys type of thing. But what I try to do is show that the good guys aren't always so good and the bad guys aren't always so bad. And that kind of story, it really appeals to me a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a murder in there. The guy who encourages Brian to cover the recycling wars gets found. Actually, Brian finds him crushed in an aluminum bale. And then he sets off to find the murderer and finds out that the major suspect is this woman that the guy who was murdered used to be with, and he's interested in her too. So he's both trying to solve the murder, and he's running up against the fact that maybe the person who did the murder is the woman he's in love with. Mm. So that gets complicated. And I can't tell you more because then I'd have to kill you. I mean,
no spoilers.
Yes. The story is, I guess you would say, a little over the top. Mm-hmm. It's realistic in the sense that it could happen, but it's more dramatic than my life certainly is. But the world it takes place in is a real world, and I did research that world a lot. And in fact, I used to have a lot more of that world in the book, but I found that I didn't want it to slow the story down. So I had, when I rewrote the book 6 or 7 times, I found myself taking more and more of the what I thought was interesting stuff about recycling out. Not because it wasn't interesting, but because it didn't move the story along fast. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write a fast-paced book.
Yeah, you know, that's always a tendency when you write that you have so much information in your head that you just want to put it all out there, and it's hard to edit out those pieces or those chunks that really aren't germane to the story.
Well, one of the concepts, I'm not really sure where I got it, that I have used in not in writing because I overwrite, but in rewriting and editing, is this concept of dominoes. You know how if you line up a bunch of dominoes and you, in the right way, and you push the front one, they all fall down, right? Mm-hmm. But if you take one out, and everything still falls down, then maybe you don't need it.
Mm.
And so that's why I try to look at everything and think, well, what if I didn't have this scene? What if I didn't have this section? Will the story still work?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is yes, well, I try to get rid of it. Now, there are some things that just, they're comic relief, or they illustrate a character, or they just are too hard for me to get rid of that I can't take out. But I'm trying to aim for that things moving fast, and if people have to slow down and think, oh, this is interesting, he's giving us a little history of the recycling industry in Oakland, California. Well, that's not what I really want to do. But it is hard, and in fact, my first published book, Phones in the Wash, which you didn't ask me about, but I'll answer it anyway, is has had, for the couple of years I was writing it, three primary characters, and all of them had sections where we saw things from their point of view. And it ended up being longer than probably it needed to be, and I actually cut one of those three characters, hundreds of pages, maybe 150 pages. And that character stayed in the book, but we never saw things through his point of view anymore. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, it was better mm-hmm. without that.
Yeah.
So, but it was very painful. It was like cutting off my arm. Mm-hmm. Well, no, it wasn't that bad. I never cut my arm off. I don't know how it feels.
No, I get that. But I think as a reader, I would say I would appreciate that because I find myself sometimes reading books where there is too much information that's really not necessary. And so I just skip over it. Which is a waste.
Yeah, do you know that there's a line by Elmore Leonard, I can't take credit for it, but I really like it. He says, you know those parts in books that you skim over?
Mm-hmm.
Leave those out.
Yep. Yep.
So
there we go. We solved that problem, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. Well, now you mentioned Bones in the Wash. Just share a bit about that. It's a political thriller set during the 2008 presidential campaign in New Mexico. I mean, that's just very interesting. How did that come to your mind?
Well, in the same way that I thought the recycling world would be an interesting place to set a novel, I thought working on a political campaign would be as well. And I'd been working, knocking on doors, in Milwaukee in 2004 for the John Kerry campaign. And I thought, well, this would be a good setting for a novel. But because I grew up in Chicago, Milwaukee didn't seem that exotic a place to set a book in. It was a lot like Chicago, a smaller version of Chicago. But in 2008, I had a chance to volunteer only for a week in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, and for the Obama campaign. And I had been there before, and New Mexico is just sort of a different kind of place with its own character, far different, certainly far different than the San Francisco Bay Area, very different than the Midwest. So it had a kind of color and exotic backdrop that I could use and tell this. And again, the story was all made up of the backdrop and the world that the story took place in was based on the real world. And even though I was only there for a week, I was able to use this, you know, this internet thing and look up pictures, and so as I was writing some description of someone driving along a road, I was able to look at a picture, and okay, it's pretty desolate out here. There's hardly any trees, but there are phone lines across the road. So I really enjoyed that, making the place almost a character. And one of my favorite reviews of Bones in the Wash was that it was like taking a vacation in New Mexico because...
Oh, wow.
Got a sense of the place as well as the story.
See, that's very interesting that you could spend a week, only a week in New Mexico and feel immersed. But then on the other hand, as you mentioned, New Mexico is such a unique place, and the feeling and the power that you get when you are in that state, in Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Taos, Arrow, wherever you are, yeah, it really makes an impression. So I understand exactly what you're saying there. And that is a compliment that you could spend a week there and then someone says it was like you're on a vacation. I love that.
Well, the other thing is I was paying attention,
mm-hmm.
and I did knock on a lot of doors, and I dare say that I probably saw more of Albuquerque than many people who live there do.
Probably.
Because, you know, I got on the bus, and I went out to a neighborhood with my list, knocked on doors, and then the next day did the same thing, and the next day did the same thing. So I was in different areas every day, and many people don't explore their own where they live as much as all that.
True.
And I got a chance to talk to people, but mostly I was paying attention and just thinking, what did I see today that is interesting, that could be something that helps describe the nature of this place?
Kind of like boots on the ground research, right?
Yeah. For example, even the fast food joints in Albuquerque, like Subway or McDonald's, have green sauce and red sauce.
Mm-hmm.
just because that's part of the culture.
Right. I love it there. I love New Mexico. It's one of my favorite places in the world, really.
I did do a reading. My sister, since I wrote the book, my sister has moved to Santa Fe.
Ooh.
And I did a reading, a house party at her house last fall. And she invited a bunch of neighbors, and it was very heartening. I said to the folks there, I said, it's arrogant enough to write a novel and expect people to, develop the time to read it. But even more arrogant is writing a novel about a place that you've only been in for, 10 days total, and giving a presentation to people who live here. But I pulled it off, apparently, because I've gotten very few responses from people where somebody says I got something wrong.
Okay.
I did spell in the early version, I did spell the name of Bandelier National Monument wrong, but that was just a typo.
Exactly.
I mean, it wasn't because I just wasn't paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to fix it, too, because these days you can upload a new version.
Exactly. Well, now, we talked about this very briefly, but one of the recurring themes in your books is, as you mentioned, the daunting challenge of doing the right thing, whether in politics, family, or relationships. Mm-hmm. Why is that important to you?
Well, I guess, probably is I just was brought up in a household where doing the right thing was considered to be a good thing, not that most people weren't, but also because it's a complicated thing. Now I read a lot. I read a lot of mysteries and spy thrillers, things that move fast. But my father was an English literature professor, and so was my brother. So I also have that sort of literature background. But what I don't care for is books that really speed along but don't have much nuance. So let me give you one example that probably many people are familiar with. Is the book The Firm by John Grisham.
Yes.
I don't feel bad saying anything about him because he's laughing all the way to the bank. I remember 15, 20, 25 years ago, whenever it came out, reading in paperback and staying up till 3 o'clock because I couldn't put it down. But I wasn't left with anything because it was like eating, too much candy or something. Mm-hmm. To get that racing plot, the characters were all black and white. A lot of sacrifices were made to get that fast pace. So I want something that moves at that pace or something close to it, but has three-dimensional characters and some sort of moral dilemma or nuanced choice that gives people something to think about. And so that's what I've aimed to do. The model, are you familiar with John le Carré, the British spy novelist?
Yes, I've heard of him.
Well, I read a lot of his stuff, and, much of the stuff he started with was Cold War, U.S. and Britain against the Soviets. And a lot of his good guys weren't so good, bad guys not so bad, because spying, after all, is about deception, whether you're representing the good guys or not. So I was attracted to that. One of his stories I do remember very well was called Little Drummer Girl, and it was not in the Cold War, but it was set in Israel, and it started an Israeli secret agent who went undercover as a Palestinian. And the thing was, the more undercover he went, the more he sort of understood Palestinian perspective. And so you get this situation where it's harder and harder for him to see things in black and white. So it's that kind of thing that has appealed to me. And just to jump ahead to the book I'm working on now, a family drama set in the, with the euthanasia plot, is that's a complicated moral dilemma. What if someone is suffering, they have cancer and dementia, and they want you to help them die, but it's illegal, and but people would say immoral. What do you do then? That's an example of the kind of theme I like to play with. Mm-hmm. The challenge there, of course, is making the book entertaining and not morbid when you're dealing with death, but still, Does that sort of answer your question?
Yes, it does answer my question, and it did take us to your upcoming book about end-of-life issues, and I was just faced with that with my mom, where she was in great pain for 8 years, and she just passed away like 5 weeks ago, but the last month or two, she kept saying to me, why is this taking so long, and what can we do about it?
Right.
And so you're faced with that question, and you're brought up thinking that it's a terrible thing, and it's an immoral thing, but when you see somebody in pain who has a right to make their own life's decision. I think it's a question we need to be talking about. So why did you decide? Did you have any personal experiences that made you decide to pick that topic?
I mean, really, I'm not sure exactly how I decided that. My mom is 93 and she's got a little dementia, but it's really not because of that. Because I actually was thinking about this a good while ago. I think because somewhere along the way I read about the Right to Die movement, which is where it's now legal in California as well as Oregon and Washington, I believe, but there's all sorts of restrictions. So, and I know people who had the same experience you have of having a parent linger for a long time and not with a high quality of life. So I thought, well, that would be interesting. So it's all made up here, but what I'm doing is I have a family, as in, at this point, it's the father and the two kids because the mother's no longer alive. And the father asked his son, who's a middle-aged therapist, to help him end his life. He's got cancer and dementia. He especially hates the dementia part, losing lucidity. The daughter won't hear anything of it. She won't even have this discussion. So the son does it. After resisting, and then the daughter accuses them at the memorial of killing their father. And so, and they end up, their personal fight between the brother and sister ends up being sort of mirrored by the Right to Die movement on the one hand and the Right to Life movement on the other hand, who sort of line up behind the two siblings. Mm-hmm. So I have this sort of family drama mixed with this large-scale political drama. So I haven't written the whole thing yet. I've only written about half of it, but it's a meaty topic, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. Do you have a title for it yet?
Well, I've got three bad titles. The first was called Edgewater, just because it was named after the building that they lived in. Second is Cheeks as Smooth as Ice, which I used to like and now I don't like anymore. that comes from the first scene where the son is sort of feeling his father's freshly shaved. But he's also cold because his blood is not pumping very well. It's a little morbid, too. And the third one is The Weight of a Nitrogen Tank, because that's how he actually does the bye.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I don't think any of them is going to work, though. I did call Bones in the Wash Turquoise Trail for many years, and then as I got closer to publishing it, I came up with another name. Mm-hmm. And I think that works better. So I'm hoping the same thing will happen here.
Oh, I'm sure it will. As you're not done. As you're writing, something will come along that will make
But Wasted was named Wasted from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to tell you one more thing about Wasted, just to jump aside. One of my friends said that I am uniquely qualified to write a book about garbage and recycling because two of my names, Burn and Bury, are two of the four ways that you dispose of waste. Burn, bury, recycle, and compost. That book I was destined to write.
Oh my gosh, see, that might be why you're smiling.
Right.
Let's talk about your writing process for a bit. Once you come up with your idea, what happens next?
Well, I just write a lot. I'm a very inefficient writer in the sense that much of the time I will not just write the scene, but I'll write notes. I write out of order. I talk to myself of like, well, what if I had Lamar is the name of the protagonist in the new book. What if I have Lamar meet this person who he does radio interviews with? So it's I wouldn't recommend it, let's put it that way. It seems like there's got to be a better way, but I think I have a lot of creative ideas. I just don't have a real linear way of approaching them. So what's worked for me, though, is to get the first draft, as wobbly as it is, together, and then go over it and over it and over it. And once I've got something beginning to end that I feel as though has the story in it, then I can go back and look at each part, mm-hmm. each page, each chapter, each character, and figure out, well, how do I make this better? I have a little notation in my that I put in the margin, which is just the letters MB, which is make better.
Uh-huh.
I don't really have a system. I used to, when I had a full-time job that I commuted to for a long, long time, I used to wake up at 6 and write for an hour and 15 minutes every morning. And I think I was actually more efficient when I had when I had less time.
Yes.
But it still took, depending on how you count, 4 or 5 years. And wasted took even longer because I put it aside
right.
and then came back to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, whatever works for you is obviously working. So, don't rethink that too much. I just wondered what your process was. Now, do you really think there's such a thing as writer's block? And if so, what do you do to get past that and move on?
I haven't really experienced writer's block as much as I've experienced just going in circles where I'm not really pushing forward.
Okay.
Because I can just, like I said, when I'm not sure where I want to go, I just start talking to myself.
Okay,
what happens next? How do I make this character, how do I get from point A to point B? What needs to happen? What if I did this? What if I did that? So I have not experienced the writer's block. The other thing is that there's just way, way too much potential research out there to study and other things that that people have written. So when I was writing about politics, we're now in the middle of another political campaign, but just in 2008, I was just such a political junkie. I was reading all of the online blogs and the newspapers and the TV punditry. So I was just deluged with mm-hmm. material all the time,
right.
and trying to find things that would work for me. I tried not to copy what was, out there in the world, but actually I did. If I want to just jump back to Bones in the Wash, one of the things that I did do there is I used the idea of dirty tricks, just political dirty tricks, shutting down voter drives, sleazy ads, and I did copy things that really happened in the world. They didn't necessarily happen in New Mexico. So that's another thing. There's always some story out there that can inform what I'm doing.
Right. Exactly.
I do want to add one thing, though, because that I missed before about my process. I often write dialogue first just because it comes easiest to me. So sometimes I'll end up with 5-6 pages, which is just 2 talking heads or 3 talking heads, back and forth, back and forth. And it might be good dialogue, but there's no scene setting, there's no activity that people are engaging in. So I have this thing I call the silent screenplay. Is that what I call it? I can't remember exactly. Where I rewrite the scene as if I can't hear anything people are saying, and as if I'm watching the movie. What will it look like? What are people doing? Moving the camera in and out. And sometimes that will only be half a page or whatever, and then I intersperse those things with the dialogue. And that really has worked for me because I forget sometimes to look at things visually. Mm-hmm. And I think the books work well because they have a lot of visual detail. I do have to tell you one sad story. It's not really sad. Is that on April Fool's Day of this year, I posted in Facebook about how thrilled I was that my book, Bones in the Wash, had been optioned for a movie, and I mentioned the actors who were in it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people didn't know that it was April Fool's Day. And so the next day I was at a meeting, and John, I'm so thrilled about your movie deal. I can't believe it. I love the book, but And you do know what day yesterday was, right?
Oh.
but one of my friends said, well, the reason a lot of people fell for it is they could actually imagine it as a movie.
Oh, okay.
Because it is cinematic in its the way it goes. So I thought, okay.
Well, instead of it being a bad joke, it actually came back to tell you something, right?
Yeah. It's just that when someone is very happy for you and you have to sort of break the news, that No,
Sorry,
not
just
really.
kidding. April Fools.
Not really.
You're funny.
Had a good cast, though. Benicio del Toro, America Ferrara,
My God.
Sydney, no, what was her name? Stanley Tucci, and I forget who the fourth one was. Oh, Diane Lane.
That is a good cast.
Oh, great.
You did well in your mind, didn't you?
Yeah.
So now you've got your third book that you're working on. Do you have anything in the works after that?
Well, I don't, but I just wrote a play, a murder mystery play that I've been in a murder mystery theater group for a couple of years here in Palm Valley where I live. And the last 2 years we purchased a play from one of these drama services. And I thought, no, I'm going to write something next year. So I wrote it. I'm rewriting it now. I actually have a, we had one reading a few weeks ago, and we have another one soon. And the hope is that it will be performed next March. And it's called Publish or Perish, the Rhubarb Valley Mystery Writers Retreat Murder Mystery. It's about a mystery writers retreat where a real murder happened. And everybody freaks out because they're writers. They're not like detectives or anything. They all think they're detectives. So after they freak out, then they all decide they want to solve the murder, and they all bump into each other doing so. And it's supposed to be funny. We'll see.
Oh, yay, that's exciting. Won't that be exciting to see that performed?
Well, it will be.
Oh
I'm
my
actually
gosh.
looking forward to, as I
Yeah.
said, to another reading that I have to schedule in the next day or two, because we hope to do it in October.
Oh, exciting. You're really cooking here. Well, we've gone through so many of the topics here today. I want to make sure that we're not missing anything that you would like to talk about.
Only that, oh, actually, there is one more thing. I actually took my two books together, and I'm about to promote it myself tomorrow or the next day. And Bones in the Wash and Wasted, both of which take place against the backdrop of an election. And I put them together into an ebook called Albuquerque to Berkeley. And it's available now. It's only 99 cents. Actually, I think it's $3.99, but it will only be 99 cents. So I'm going to be plugging that in the next, until now, until Election Day. Because getting the word out about one's books is a challenge.
Yes.
I've often used the C.T. Barnum line, which is, without promotion, something terrible can happen. Nothing. I'm plugging that, and greennoir.com is my website, GREENNOIR.com. And everything can be found there. When I get the podcast of this, I will post a link to that up there as well.
Excellent, excellent. So folks can go to your website, greennoir.com. Well, this has been such a pleasure for me, and I know our listeners as well. I encourage everyone to head over to greennoir.com. John, what a pleasure to have you here today. Keep us
Well,
posted on the new book as well.
okay, thanks so much. I really enjoyed talking with you.